Welcome back to Magnificat Radio, MagnificatMedia.com. All right, your morning tradition up and on it for Tuesday, February the 23rd. Here on your morning tradition, where we are
living our faith.
Mike and Lisa Austin with you. Coming up, I have another twins story. Remember we touched on a little story about twins the other day?
Yes.
All right, we're going to end the day with that, or our show with that today. But right now, we're talking with Mr. Robert F. Garrison. He is a historian, a teacher at St. Padre Pio Academy in Ridgefield, Connecticut. And I just love talking history with Mr. Garrison. Okay, so we're talking to King Charles I of England, the Anglican Church, the political, historical, religious, the moral ramifications of the split, and then a Puritanism. And while we were on break, here's something that came to me, Mr. Garrison. All right, so we're talking the Anglican Church, and all I know today, if we're talking any kind of reconciliation here today, the Anglican Church is the church where they have, like, female bishops and stuff like that.
Well, this was the English Church, so it's always housed these two wings, the ones that are essentially Catholic and the ones that are way off there in the Calvinist world.
Right.
And this has come down to our day. So you have, on one hand, whom we call High Anglicans, the Anglo-Catholics, who are more Catholic than some Catholics, and then you've got some low churches who they might as well be worshiping trees in the backyard.
Oh, wow.
And yet they all get to call themselves Anglican. See, this is the tragedy with the Anglican Church, unlike the Orthodox churches. Dealing with the Orthodox churches will be between churches. The Patriarch of Constantinople, the Patriarch of Moscow, the Patriarch of wherever else, and the Pope will decide, God willing, this schism is done. As a unit, the pieces will be put back together. Unfortunately, the Queen, the Archbishop of Canterbury, could get together tomorrow with the Pope, at least the Queen, there are rumors she would favor such a thing. They could all get together and decide this tomorrow, and 90% of what is called the Anglican Communion, made up of the people who would worship the trees in the backyard, have married bishops and gay clergy, they'd say, we don't go along with that. And the Anglican Church would have very few people in it after that. And as it is the official Church of England, when you suddenly have 90% of the church go away, there would be all sorts of constitutional problems and whatever. The Queen cannot express herself in public in any matter because that's just the English constitutional situation. She doesn't actually run the Church of England as a whole. She is the supreme governor of the Church of England, but there is, of course, a committee that runs it. With the exception of certain churches, and I do love the English words, that are called royal peculiars. They're directly under... They're directly under her control, and she appoints their prelates. Well, one of them is Westminster Abbey, the Church of St. Edward the Confessor, dedicated to St. Peter the Apostle, the first pope, where both the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Pope knelt when Pope Benedict visited England and prayed. And she appointed the Dean of Westminster. She's appointed. And these men, as they are usually described, are rather conservative and pro-Catholic in their attitudes and things.
Mm-hmm. Well,
but anyway, this is the predicament of the Anglican Church today, which Charles was fighting the forces that would create the Anglican. Had he taken out the Puritans, if I can speak in those crude terms, the schism between Rome and Canterbury may well have been healed long ago.
Mm.
But the Puritans won.
Yes.
And the result of that has been the continued schism. I want to give you a couple other things. The one line that is always presented, because now we're going to get into the political and the moral.
Yes.
He's famous for this line, and he's spoken on the day he died. So, as he himself said, I'm about to meet my maker. I'm not going to lie to you.
Right.
I'll be meeting my judge very shortly here. But he said basically this: for the people, I desire their liberty and freedom as much as anybody whomsoever. But I must tell you, their liberty and freedom consists in having of government those laws by which their life and their goods may be most their own. It is not for having a share in government. This is nothing pertaining to them. A subject and a sovereign are clean different things. And therefore, until they do that, I mean that they do put the people in that liberty, as I say, certainly they will never be happy themselves. Sirs, it was for this that I come here. If I would have given away to the arbitrary way, in other words, their force, For to have all laws change according to the power of the sword, I needed not have come here. And therefore I tell you, and I pray God that it not be laid at your charge, that I am the martyr of the people. Now, everybody always zeroes in on that, you know, having a part of government is not pertaining to the people. And, of course, all Americans immediately get all fluffy-chested and all sort of... Okay, what did government entail in the 1600s? Defending the realm and keeping the peace. And that was pretty much it. Well, most normal farmers probably would have said, I don't know, it's not my job to protect the realm, that's the king's job.
Right.
Not my job to protect the streets of London, that's his job. So... what government was seen to be back then was, shall we would say in our language, very limited. But what was pertaining to the people was to have laws by which their lives and their property and their goods are most their own. We have this utopian view of life, and Americans especially, most people do, but Americans have it. It's a human flaw. But your politics and your religious things you've inherited help do this, and it's a Puritan streak. Like, we want our good guys to be perfect, and all bad guys are like just, they're all Hitler. Well, you know, human life's a little bit more complex than that. Charles I was not a perfect man. I mean, I'd like to know anybody who is.
Right.
Right.
He was a decent man. He had his flaws. He knew them. All his life he worked to correct his flaws. He was not the greatest general. I mean, he did lose the Civil War, but he was certainly a brave man. So on every level, this is a man of admirable qualities. The king himself, again, before he dies, he writes this. For I can be content to receive, I mean, I'm going to translate this as I go into modern English. Sort.
Please do.
I would be content to give up much of my own interests and my personal rights, all right, even though I have a right to them. But in what concerns truth, justice, the right of the church, and my crown, together with the general good of my kingdoms, here I am and ever shall be fixed and resolute. Nor shall any man gain my consent to that, wherein my heart gives my tongue or hand the lie. In other words, if I know it's wrong, I am not consenting to it. Nor will I be brought to affirm to men, which in my conscience I denied before God. In other words, if I'm saying one thing to God, I'm not going to say opposite for political reason.
Right.
I will rather choose to wear the crown of thorns with my Savior, than to exchange that of gold, which is my due, for one of lead. And this crown of lead, which is what he would have worn if he had accepted their compromises, whose embased flexibleness shall be forced to bend and comply to the factions and often contrary dictates of any factions. In other words, they want me to consent to a situation where I must, on basic moral and religious issues, bend and comply to whatever the winds of the day say. Now, what explains our world today?
I was just going to say,
of our politicians, what has not fallen because we've given into it. I mean, we've redefined marriage. I don't think even the Puritans would have figured that one out back then.
Oh no,
it's like you actually have people look at you, and when you say, "Well, marriage is between a man and a woman," they look at you. Well, that's not. They look at you like you're nuts. It's like, what happened? Even our vaunted conservatives in our American society have been so. I mean, you almost listen to them when they speak. They're in terror. They lost society, and they don't know how to get it back. Because the one thing that could get it back, religion, faith, the true faith, they've already accepted that that's in your own little private niche. That's your private club. That has nothing to do with public policy. Now, I don't know, I can't say that Charles I could even have imagined things would have gotten this horrible. But you see the enemy of all he stood for is still with us. Those words are what just jumped out at me and said, that's just so true.
Right, it could be written today.
I mean, he could look down on us and say, I told you so. He is a symbol both for the possibility of healing the religious schism, which we should all hope for. He is a symbol in what we have to come to grips with in dealing with the moral and the political problem. And see, that's where we have the problem. All right? People brought up in our culture had just been brought up to this knee-jerk reaction against monarchy. And I'm not here to harp on monarchy as such, but we fail to see that the reason it is always attacked is because it's essentially, as I said before, it just looks too Catholic.
Right.
And in a way, in that monarchy stands, his son, Charles II, he at least won us a last breather. He finally trumped Parliament before his reign ended. The fruit of that tree, of Charles I's genetic tree, is Catholic fruit, even within his family. So that's gotta mean something,
mm-hmm.
right?
It does.
Mm-hmm. And Charles II, because Parliament, the Whigs, and that's ultimately what they became, the famous Whigs, never stopped. And they didn't want another civil war because nobody wanted that, but they really did want to whittle down the monarchy. They wanted to get rid of the Catholic influence. And the fact that Charles's heir was his brother James, they did not want that. So they kept chopping away, trying to destroy, again, the hereditary nature of the monarchy, which a monarchist would say, well, it's a human institution. It reflects the family. Monarchy is not the rule of one man. It's the enshrinement of family as the center of society. You know, that's the essence of it. The Whigs, who were the successors, the heirs to the Puritans, they can't stand that. Simon Schama, he's an English historian, Sir Simon Schama, he's no Catholic. I characterizes himself as a socialist. He's Jewish by birth. He's a good historian. And I'm not even saying he's favorable to the Stuarts. But he describes accurately, he said, the great conflict between the Stuarts and the Whigs, the Stuarts still held to a vision of society based on honor.
We owe a debt to Charles I, even in this mm-hmm. country.
You always come back to that, and to the cause he stood for, all right?
Right.
Now, the Anglicans, you know, as I say, the Anglican Church canonized him. Obviously, as Roman Catholics, we, you know, that such decisions are in the hand of the Pope, and you don't make them yourself. You can have whatever private determinations you have. But he is one of those figures that instead of denigrating, we should learn from, even if only on the personal level. And the last little piece of just symbolic wonderfulness, after the condemnation, they let him out to be executed, and then they sat him in a room for 2.5 hours, making him kind of sweat, making him wait.
Mm-hmm.
And the bishop who accompanied him to the scaffold, who went as his confessor or whatever, you know, was appalled by this and said, the poor man, he said, well, at least have something to eat while you wait. So he went to the guards and said, give him something. He's sitting here. He was perfectly calm and utterly, utterly resolved. And they said, all right, we'll get him. So they brought in a plate. They brought in a piece of bread and a glass of wine. His last meal, his last supper. It is symbolic. It's not the sacrament he had received.
No.
By his rights, the sacrament. But it's like, this is how they treated him. And you see the same thing running through so many other things in the stuff we are taught, because the left, the revolution, as I always call it, this power that's been at us for hundreds of years now, it depends on myths. And one of the myths that we have bought, hook, line, and sinker, is that the kings were bad, the rebels were always good because they were always for freedom. But then when we look into it, we find that the rebels usually hated the kings because the kings looked too Catholic. And the rebels ended up being, well, Hitler was a revolutionary.
Hmm.
Mao was a revolutionary. If that's what you consider better than the past, you got a problem going on.
Knowing
Charles I?
Knowing history will, like we always say, you can't know where you're going if you don't know where you've been. So.
That's right. That's why you have to know the true history.
Robert F. Garrison, historian, master's of religious study, teacher, and friend.
And King's man, I'm proud to say.
And King's man. I like that. And King's man. Monarchist you monarchist, Roman monarchist you.
Yep.
Teacher at St. Padre Pio Academy in Ridgefield, Connecticut. Again, thank you for your talk on Charles I. And,
Mike, it is always a pleasure.
We look forward to it again, sir. Have a great day. God bless.
You too. God bless you.
Robert F. Garrison. And Charles I, that's a great lecture, really.
It is.
And
I enjoyed listening to him.
We're actually talking to Mr. Garrison about doing his own sort of historical show, with a, you know, like the Catholic bent on things.
Mm-hmm.
Not that it's a bent, it's the truth.
It's the truth.
As we mentioned, as he mentioned, oftentimes you don't get in your history books or in
exactly,
you know, the normal stuff. So working on that, it always comes down to a time. And, of course, everyone's volunteering their time for us here. So
they are.
So we can't expect him to you know, put off his regular job and things. But we're going to come back and give a little talk on twins. This is a funny little story.
I can't wait to hear it.
It's kind of weird. Almost a miracle story, really. Magnificat Radio at MagnificatMedia.com. Welcome to your morning tradition here for a Tuesday, February the 23rd. Your morning tradition where we are.
Living our faith.
And we are back. Magnificat Radio at MagnificatMedia.com. It's your morning tradition where we are.
Living our faith.
Mike and Lisa Austin here on the microphones in the bunker. Refreshing kind of morning. Tuesday, February the 23rd, another day closer to springtime. Although we're in a little cold snap here, but...
Mm-hmm, that's true.
Yeah, they are still having some fairly warm weather to the south. I mean, down in, like, Oklahoma, Texas, down in there. Friends of mine down there, they were saying, well, 70s the other day there, and I think they're probably the 50s now, but...
Well, I can't wait till that comes our way.
Come on, bring it on.
Mm-hmm.
I hope we don't get... I'm at that point where cabin fever says, I hope we don't get any more snow.
Yeah, me too.
I'm kind of done with it.
Yeah. I'm on board with you.
Thank you, my dear.
You're welcome.
We are anti-snow together. They do everything together. I'm talking about defying all the odds. Identical twin sisters Carrie Bunker and Kelly Wall of Salt Lake City, Utah, gave birth the other day to sets of twins for the second time each.
I know, isn't that amazing?
Am I getting this right? They're sisters.
And they're twins.
And they're twins.
Identical twins.
And they each gave birth
to twins.
To twins twice now.
Correct.
There's got to be some kind of weird... Are they on... Is this like a fertility drug thing or something?
I don't think so.
Wall gave birth to her pair 8 weeks early. Bunkers arrived a month before their due date. So they were born on the same day?
No. One's 8 weeks, one's a month. That's 4 weeks.
No, but I'm saying the one ladies came 8 weeks early.
Uh-huh.
The other ladies arrived a month before their due date. Two different due dates, but they arrived. So did they arrive on the same day?
I don't think so.
Each set of twins and their mothers are doing great, perfectly healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Mrs. Bunker.
Hey, Edith, huh?
Admitted that she and her husband Archie. No, I'm just kidding.
Could you imagine?
Oh, we were in shock when I heard the news.
Mrs. Bunker, people of a certain age are the only ones that are understanding what we're chuckling about right now.
Oh my gosh, that's hilarious.
I didn't get that until I just hope they don't name one of the kids Meathead. Our jaws dropped. We weren't trying for children. We weren't even expecting them, let alone two. Wall and her husband wanted another child and couldn't believe she was having doubles again.
Again.
We rolled doubles.
Yeah.
I felt super shocked. It was a surprise. The moms joked that while they will never be able to do dinner again,
right,
they will get through this double duty together. Bunker said... I won't talk like you, the Bunker. Both of us still look at each other and think, did this really happen? Wall admits, yes, there are days I'm frightened. Oh my gosh, I think, how can I handle this? But we've done this once before, so.
That's something. Isn't that a nice story?
What are the odds? The odds are going to be near impossible.
I think so, because like I told you before, it skips a generation, but it didn't skip them. And they had it. Twice.
It doesn't sound like this was a fertility drug thing.
No, it doesn't.
Well,
sounds like it was all natural to me.
God decided they needed more twins.
That's right.
So there you are. Well, isn't that from Adam and Eve? Wasn't it twins?
Yes, they did. Like 28 of
right.
them.
Like I said to a friend the other day.
28 sets of twins.
Friend of mine the other day. I says, hey, you know, God is still God. It's the same God that parted the Red Sea. You think maybe your prayers might be answered? You think he can handle your stuff? It's the same guy.
Of course.
Think if he wants you to have twins 3-4 times, it'll probably happen.
Uh-huh.
All right. That's a cool story, though. I love twin stories.
That is.
That's going to do it for us today. Our thanks to our good friend Robert F. Garrison, historian, downright cool dude sickle. And I don't think he has that on his business card.
I don't think so, Mike.
We welcome.
A little more prestigious.
We welcome him. We're being on our show. Talking with Charles
Top Dude Sickle.
Yeah.
At your service.
Hello. That'd be hard when to get on there. And our thanks to him. Our thanks to Stephen Cox, as always. And our thanks to you for being part of our day and
sure.
part of our family here on Magnificat Radio and your morning tradition. Oh, long live. What do we say? Praise be Jesus and Mary.
Now and forever.
Your morning tradition. Where we are.
Living our faith.